If a player cleans his ball during play of a hole, except on the putting green, he shall incur a penalty of one stroke. That's a rule, Jerry.
But it's just a friendly game. Why do you always have to be such a stickler?
Because that's the way I was raised.
Welcome to Spirit of the Game, brought to you by the Colorado Golf Association. Here are your hosts, Ed Mate and Lewis Harry.
Okay, it's time once again for another Spirit of the Game. This is Ed Mate. It's now August. It's hard to believe the summer's flying by, and I am so thrilled to be joined today with a new co-host, Mr. Brad Weasley. Brad, thanks for joining.
Pleasure to be here, Ed.
So why don't you tell our listener, I always joke about that. I know we have multiple listeners now and growing all the time. Tell us about your background and the rules and why I asked you to join me for this month's Spirit of the Game.
So I have been volunteering with the CGA for close to 15 years now. Started as a wet behind the ears rule official that number of years ago, and have really enjoyed my time working on course with players, helping them through situations, and volunteering for the CGA to where I'm now on the State Rules of Golf Committee, on the board of directors for the CGA, and I do a few things nationally for college golf with the NCAA, and just got back from a USGA tournament in California.
Which one was that?
That was the girls junior in LA.
Ah, and I saw that the finalist, runner-up from last year, won. That was amazing.
She did, and I watched the final broadcast. I was home by then. As the numbers dwindle of players, they need fewer referees, but I was amazed that in the 29 holes they played of the finals match, she had 14 birdies and no bogeys.
That's incredible. I always enjoyed when I worked the USGA Championship to come back and be able to watch the finish on television, because you were so familiar, obviously, with the golf course. So that was always one of the highlights for me. And frankly, at the end of the tournament, it's kind of fun to be on the couch.
Indeed. And for anybody who might have seen that over the weekend or the replays, just like the Masters, I don't think TV did justice to the terrain of that golf course. El Cab in Tarzana has a lot of up and down, and it just, you know, I knew it because I'd been there, but you couldn't really tell it on TV.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to jump right in here. I think we have a very fun topic. Today's topic is the top five get out of jail free rulings that Ed and Brad could come up with. And I'm sure that we missed many, but what prompted this was the Scottish Open. So for those who missed it, Robert McIntyre, the eventual champion, hit his ball offline on the par 5 16th. And as it turned out, and I wrote about this in the column for this month's newsletter and teased this podcast. So for those that want to kind of get into the native with us. And as it turned out, his ball came to rest in a location where he was going to be standing on a sprinkler head. Why there was a sprinkler head out in the native, I don't know. Typically native areas, particularly on links golf courses, are not watered. You kind of get the whims of nature in terms of how thick it is. So that puzzles me. Maybe it wasn't a sprinkler head. Maybe it was a control box of some sort. Who knows? But it was an immovable obstruction. And the ultimate outcome was he was given a free drop, which led to a much improved lie, to say the least. Went from probably a hack out to a full-on go for the green and two on a shortest reachable par five, and hit in a miraculous shot. I mean, the shot, can't take anything away from the shot. But I'd have to say the lead-up to the shot was tainted, in my view, by this intervening free relief. So that led to a par birdie finish, and what a win for the hometown hero. So it was fabulous. So it just got me thinking about what other rulings over the history of golf can we come up with that are kind of similar, get out of jail free. And maybe for a future podcast, we'll do one on the opposite, the worst rulings or the bad break rulings. And there's probably a lot more of those because they stand out. So Brad, I would just love for you to react to what you saw or heard or read about with McIntyre. And I'm going to ask you this question. I've heard commentary, because you and I are both podcast lovers, that a golfer should not get relief for an immovable obstruction when it's only their stance that's interfered with. They understand lie. They understand area of intended swing for safety, but there was no risk here. Why couldn't he have just played or been forced to play by standing on that? So I'd love for your reaction to that.
So Ed, I may go down a rabbit hole that you don't want to go down, but I see this from a vantage of when should you get stance? When should you not get stance relief? If you're standing on a cart path, you clearly get relief for that, even if your ball's not on the cart path. And I've seen players in the fairway where they've got sprinkler heads that are recessed into the ground, maybe 4 or 5 inches. And there's a fairly big hole there that they would be, you know, either having their heel or toe in, and they get relief for that, generally speaking. So just like having a ball, you know, in a divot hole or not in a divot hole in a fairway, the debates about that, we could go on and on about when you get relief for stance with an obstruction. You know, does it have to be directly under your foot? Does it have to be 2 inches above or below the ground? And so I think just having one rule where you either get it or you don't, if you're standing on it, you get it, makes more sense than trying to say, well, if it's in the rough, you don't get relief. If it's in the fairway, you do, that sort of thing. That brings up other problems that would have unintended consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. And I in my column, I do, and maybe you can touch on this because my rules, and I'm not saying this to be self-deprecating, I'm being honest. My rules knowledge is getting a bit rusty because I'm not out in the field like a foreign language. If you don't use it, you lose it. But there is language in this particular rule, abnormal course conditions, which are now bundled under one heading. So things like ground under repair, temporary water, these things that you get free relief from are kind of bundled. They used to be under separate rules, but within that rule, there is a sort of an exception that says you don't get relief if you are creating interference by taking an abnormal stance or unusual line of play. I'm paraphrasing. Or if you are clearly in an unplayable situation that has nothing to do with the obstruction. So when you look at McIntyre, could an argument have been made or a rules official have said, look, you would not be advancing that ball. You'd be declaring that ball unplayable if it wasn't for this coincidental interference from the obstruction. My own reaction to my own question there is he probably could have advanced it, wouldn't have been very far, but he did have a play. And the sort of catch-all question to ask an official or the player is asking the player in that situation, what would you do if that obstruction were not there? And the answer you're looking for is clarity to help guide the ruling. If the player says, well, I declare it unplayable, then as rules officials, we say, very good. That's what we're going to do. Love for you to react to that.
Well, I think you've hit it on the head, Ed. I actually had a player in a college tournament this spring whose ball was sort of in the base of a bush and stance was on a small animal hole. And you get relief for animal holes for stance, lie a ball, and swing. And so the player, you know, is telling me that he needs relief because he's standing on an animal hole. And I ask him, you know, what would you do if that animal hole wasn't there? The exact question that you proposed. And he said, I'd hit the ball. I would be able to get the ball out of that edge of that bush. It might be sideways towards the fairway, but I'd have a shot. And so under those circumstances, the player got relief because I believe that they really did have a shot. And so in this case with McIntyre, would he have gotten to the green from where he was at? Maybe not. Would he have advanced the ball down the fairway to where he could have gotten to the green on his next shot? I think that's likely based on the replays I saw. And so, you know, relief is appropriate. The times that, you know, I've seen where you don't have relief under the rules, your ball, you know, you're standing on a cart path, but your ball is in a tree root and you can't even get a club on it. Well, it's not a practical shot that you can make. And so the rules don't provide for relief for that because you couldn't make a shot either with or without the cart path.
Perfect segue to our next situation. And this is one of the most memorable tournaments, probably the most memorable tournament I've ever watched, the 1999 Open Championship at Carnoustie. This is the Van de Velde Open. And I've always said, if John Van de Velde was looking for immortality, he achieved his goal. If he had gone on to win that tournament, we probably would not remember it. He would be a one-hit wonder. Instead, he is forever just... his name is not carved into the claret jug, but boy, is it carved into our memories. So this is 1999. And the reason I said it was a good segue, there were two rulings that stood out in my mind from this tournament. One was with David Frost. He was in the Carnoustie native, you know, with a very challenging shot, and he was trying to create interference. At least this was what I saw, by taking an unusually wide stance to create, to get his edge of his heel onto a cart path. It wasn't a like a asphalt path. It was a beaten down, but it was a path. It was an obstruction. And the rules official was denying him relief by saying, you are creating, you would not take that stance if it wasn't for trying to improve the lie of this ball. That was the position the official took, and he held his ground. He would not budge. And Frost went on to play the ball out of the terrible lie. He couldn't admit his that he was being less than honest. So he went ahead and maintained that silly stance. I said it looked like he was a giraffe taking a drink of water. It was so absurd. So, but that's not the ruling that. But exactly what you're talking about, Brad. A situation where the player was denied relief for creating interference or taking an abnormal, in this case, stance. It wasn't direction of play, but an abnormal stance. Curious to get any other situations that you think of that maybe you've been involved with where you had to deny a player relief that come to mind.
Oh, I've had a number of times where you see this, you know, you've watched a player play generally, especially on a multi-day tournament, you see most of the players play shots at some point or the other. And then you get that odd stance where they're either, you know, very feet are wide apart, trying to get onto a sprinkler head or a cart path or something like that. And, you know, typically I'll just, you know, nicely say, that's not the stance that I've seen you hit over several shots in the last day or two. Let's take the normal stance that you've been using and see if that gets you where you're going. Most of the time it does not, and they get the point and on we go.
Yeah. So let's, the one I wanted to talk about, and I doubt very many people remember this, but I remember it clearly because I learned something about TIOs. So Van de Velde during the third round, can't remember what hole it was, but he hit his ball way off into the native, and there was a television tower intervening between he and the fairway. So it was not on his line to the hole, but it seemed reasonable for him to hit it. It would have been a logical, reasonable play for him to hit it out sideways 90 degrees to the fairway. At the time, the RNA had walking officials in every group, and he was given relief. I later learned that he was not entitled to relief. It was a botched ruling because the TIO rule specifies that you only get relief if it intervenes between you and the hole. So line of play, direction of play, reasonable or unreasonable, really is not factored into the calculus. So he was given relief, got a great break, dropped it into, similar to McIntyre, a fluffy lie, hit it on the green, saved par, and it was a big deal. I remember Curtis Strange going, wow, what a great break. Of course, maybe that was the golfing god's way on the final hole of evening the score. So anyway, any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, TIOs or temporary immovable obstructions are, you know, something you see on TV all the time. And in my 40 plus years of playing golf, I don't know that I've ever encountered one on a normal golf course that you're out playing just for recreational purposes. So they get a lot of publicity and they pop up in strange spots, but you know, for the professional game, you really do need to get relief from those things if you're, you know, going for the hole. But you know, as you said, if you're going sideways to the fairway, there are a number of routes to get there, and you don't get relief, you know, if you have an open way to get there.
No, I like the way you put that. That's kind of, because that does sort of provide a little bit of the why. Why is it that you get relief for a TIO when it intervenes between you and the hole, but not in a situation where you're just going out sideways? And you say there's a number of ways to get there. You could hit it backward. You could hit it 10 yards further forward. This is definitely a sort of a part of the rules that I do think if you really were to go back and research it, you would find lots of interesting back and forths between players and rules officials where a player is either denied relief or given relief. Another one that comes to mind, it just came into my head, was Kendra Graham denying, and I believe it was Annika Sorenstam relief, where there was a TIO intervening between her ball and the hole. However, in between all of that was a forest of trees. And I apologize to Annika and Kendra if I got the names wrong. The situation holds, because this does come up, where you have this other factor. It's not just the TIO that's in their way. It's like a forest of trees that are in their way. So a player will often say, well, I could get it through those trees and I would work it around that one limb, and then the scoreboard would block me from getting to the green. And that generally, I'd say in most cases, does not pass the giggle test. But that's another one of those caveats that rules officials need to think about. And I think a theme here is subjectivity is part of rulings. People think that the rules are black and white. Well, nothing's black and white in life, and the rules are no different.
Well, and one of the things that I've learned from refereeing at a fairly high level is good players have shots that the average player probably does not have. I've seen college players, professional players, players in USGA tournaments, you know, get in situations and they say they've got a shot. I tend to believe them. I may not have that shot, but I've seen a number of them hit shots that I simply don't have. So, you know, when you get to the higher levels of golf, players may get a little more forbearance on things that they say they can do than your average bogey golfer.
Yep, absolutely. So before we leave our friend John Vandeveld, we were talking before we hit record, and you made a point. Refresh my memory on how he played 18.
So I think the most important part on there when talking about TIOs is his second shot. I mean, he hit kind of a bad driver, and he came into 18, Ed, with a 3-stroke lead. You know, it's a par 4. He could have made a 6 and still won the tournament by 1. I have a friend who's also a rules official and has caddied some. And he says, you know, if you get to the 18th tee and the player's thinking about doing something silly, you know, the only club available might be a 6 or a 7 iron to hit a safe one up the fairway and
that's right,
make your way to the green and win the tournament. But Jean hit driver, almost put it in the Berry Burn, which, you know, is a little creek, or it's a term in Scotland, Great Britain, for, you know, a waterway. Came to rest.
Hey, Brett, let me insert right there. At that point in time, when he hit that tee shot, it was so offline. It was perfect. I mean, it turned out that's where his caddy blew it, was not letting him hit driver. Well, he did. Okay, now that's where the disaster, because that was like wedge. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he could have hit a couple of easy shots back to the 18th fairway onto the green, and he could have still 3-putted and won the tournament. But he decided to go for the green with a 2-iron on his second shot. And this is where it gets a little bit interesting. He flew it towards a grandstand on 18, hit a railing, it bounced backwards, hit a wall that was by the burn, took a huge bounce off that wall and into some really deep rough further away from the green. Now this is, you mentioned the golf gods and golf karma. He got the good break earlier. If his ball would have gone into the grandstand instead of bouncing off the railing, he would have been in a temporary immovable obstruction, or a TIO, and he would have gotten relief for that, a drop, which would have been an easy or fairly straightforward chip onto the green. And you know, he walks away with the tournament. We're not talking about it, and nobody remembers. But he got a bad break and ended up, you know, on his second shot of 7, going into a bad place, and his further errors just compounded that until he ended up with a triple bogey seven, tied with two other players, Justin Leonard and the eventual winner, Paul Lowry, you know, after they had a playoff with the three players tied after 72 holes.
Yeah. Anytime you take your socks off in playing a hole, it's not a good thing. And that's, let's just say that that did unfold. If you, I'm sure YouTube has this one well documented.
It does. And this is one that I remember sitting on the couch midday on a Sunday. I love the Open because I like the time frame, breakfast golf, you know, from the mother country and all of that. So it's one of my favorite watches of the summer. And I remember sitting on the couch watching this thing unfold going, oh my goodness.
I remember Johnny Miller. I think it was Johnny Miller. I may be blending, but somebody said, my goodness, you don't need to ride in on a white horse. He might've used it on another, I think it was in another tournament. Cause I don't think he was, this was an ABC broadcast, but he used it in other cases. Just win the tournament. All right, let's move on. Okay. So again, the numbers on these are not necessarily, they're arguable whether they are the most notable or not. This probably would be number one on many people's list. And it does involve a free drop, kind of in air quotes. But it's memorable because of the player that was involved, and that was Arnold Palmer. This is 1958. And I was doing a little research on this, and the article that sort of summarized it reminded the reader that Palmer was not Palmer in 1958. It was pre-Arnie's Army. He was obviously charismatic and an incredibly talented young player. So I think contextually it's important that Nate, because I think as we look back on history, we tend to kind of take shortcuts. And the assumption was that Palmer got a friendly ruling because he was the iconic Arnold Palmer. I'm not sure that's necessarily the case. But real quickly, what happened, and this is very well documented in Ken Venturi's autobiography, and I think Palmer was pretty emphatic and led to some pretty hard feelings between these two players. But on the 12th hole, Palmer's ball came into a lie that he thought was embedded, or the sequencing of all this is really up for dispute. And did he follow the correct procedure? And when your ball comes to rest in a lie where there's some doubt, there is a very exacting procedure that needs to be followed. And according to Ken Venturi, Palmer played a poor shot, went ahead and hold out, made double bogey, and then retroactively said, you know, I think that ball was embedded. And that's where the rub is, because Palmer said, no, I made it clear to the official that I was disputing and going to play a second ball. And said, I followed the procedure. And again, I don't think it's worth the time to go back and deconstruct what the doubt as to procedure rule looked like in 1958 versus today. It's probably one of the more complicated rules, even though it's the intention of it's very simple. Let's get the player back playing when there's no official nearby. So anyway, ultimately what happened is he did play a second ball. He was granted free relief for the embedded ball. And he went on to make a three with that ball. That was the score that the committee ultimately allowed him to count, right or wrong. And Palmer went on to win and obviously became the Palmer that we know. And certainly history would be different if that didn't play out that way. What are your thoughts and reactions to that one?
I think there are so many good examples out of that. Ed, it brings up the rule on playing two balls. And I think tournament players really need to be familiar with that rule and how it operates in order to use it effectively when they're playing in tournaments. But, you know, I try not to go back and second guess rulings from the past. The officials did the best job they could at the time. You know, every shot wasn't on TV like they are now. I was born in 1959, so I missed this one. Wasn't sitting on the couch watching it, but I've read about it. And I'm not even sure this was on TV at the time. Would they televise like the last four holes of a tournament?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so this one didn't get a lot of scrutiny. And, you know, the committee took the information, made their ruling. And frankly, I'm good with it, absent, you know, any real evidence to go beyond it. But today, everything on TV in the professional game is pretty well documented with a TV camera. I would put in a little aside to players listening. if you're playing in a tournament and you're intending to play two balls, you have your cell phone with you in all likelihood. Take pictures. From an officiating standpoint, a player who has taken pictures of where their ball is before they played it and the conditions they want relief from, that's just invaluable 2 hours later when you're in scoring and you are explaining the situation. A photo really is worth a thousand words, and players that have taken pictures have really helped us come to a proper conclusion when we're deciding these two ball things.
Yeah, excellent point. And taking that a step further, use your cell phone to make a phone call. And sometimes you can just walk through it, explain exactly what it is you're seeking. And I know that that's been a huge time saver, because a lot of times that doubt can be quickly resolved in a very simple, you know, is this, what's the status of this object on hole 15? Well, that's a clear answer. That's integral, no relief, and off you go. Taking pictures is a great point. Before we leave that one, what else would you tell players about the doubt is to procedure? I want to see if your answer and mine are the same. What else would you advise players other than what you just said, take pictures? What else is really, really, really important? Go ahead.
In this long rule, I think there's a couple of really important parts. One of them is you have to have some doubt as to how you're proceeding. You know, is it ground under repair and it's just not marked and you should get relief for it? Once you've got some situation where you don't know how to proceed, you've got to tell somebody else in the group that you're going to play two balls. And you've got to do that before you play the two balls. And you should, they say should, not must, because some players don't, and we've got to have a way to get out of it and make a ruling if they don't. But you should declare which ball you want to count if the rules allow that ball to count. And in most cases, I say most because there are exceptions, the player is going to want the ball that they're taking relief with, or the second ball typically, to be the ball that counts. But there is at least one specific example that I can think of when you want the original ball to count. And that example, you want it to count really badly, because if you're not sure your original ball's out of bounds, so you're going to play two balls for that, you'd really like that ball to be in bounds and not be playing under stroke and distance for a ball that's out of bounds.
What a great point. Because I think the assumption is, and again, it's like you said, most situations, probably the classic situation is your ball's in a bad lie and you think it should have been marked as ground under repair. That's probably, wouldn't you say, Brad, balls are a result of that situation?
Yeah, I think that's probably the vast majority of them.
Right. But the key that you said there, and it goes back to the Venturi Palmer situation, you must explain what you're doing and you must announce, and you can't play the stroke and then say, you know what, I should have announced that because I didn't hit nearly as good a shot out of that crummy lie as I thought I could. You can't do that. You have one chance and you have to do it before taking further action. That is so important because the rules are set up to not give you choices, or at least limit choices, where you're like, you know, I'm going to play the provisional. No, I think I'll play the original. No, the rules are work really hard to avoid those kinds of choices. And this rule is no different.
Indeed. And a couple of quick things. I was working a qualifier a couple of weeks ago, and there were only a couple of officials there. My phone number was on the notice to players, and I get a call from a player who says, hey, our group was talking and I was just in a bad lie. I've played the ball, but I'd like to play a second ball. Well, pretty easy on that one, because the rule says you've got to make a decision to play two balls and do all the technical work before you've taken further action or played the ball. So that ship had sailed for this player. It's just, you've played the ball, play on.
The other question I like to ask, and I think on one occasion it actually saved me a trip back out on the golf course, because you don't generally, it's one of those lead the witness questions. Did you announce which ball you wanted to score with? I always like to ask that, just to kind of, I'm not trying to trap the player, but I do want to see how they answer it. So, hey, I played two balls. In the day and age of photos, I'm not sure, technology, cell phones, it may not be as useful. But I have, in one situation, is quite memorable. I said to the player, did you announce which ball you wanted to score with? And he answered honestly, no, I didn't. I didn't know I had to. And I said, well, we just saved ourselves a trip out because we're going to count the original ball. Now, again, that may not be the bedside manner most rules officials would use, but it definitely, maybe I was just lazy.
Well, there is now, starting in 2019, there is a procedure in the clarifications book about what to do if the player doesn't declare. And it's a fairly complicated procedure to walk through and figure out which ball counts. But
yeah, I won't be using that one then because I don't want complicated. All right. We're counting down. We're down to the last two. And this is a coin flip. And the reason I put this one at number two and not at number one is it didn't ultimately lead to a win. To me, the ultimate get out of jail free is if the final chapter's written and the player ended up winning the tournament as a result. And this was part of the lead up or was part of the narrative that got them to that ultimate win. This one, I know many people will remember, and this is the classic, this is at the Masters. I say classic piled for removal ruling. It involved our very own Will Nicholson Jr., who is chairman of the competitions committee at the Masters. This is in the year Mickelson won his first Masters in 2004. He hit his ball left on 11. There was an ice storm prior to the tournament, and there was a bunch of downed limbs that were piled in the woods. I mean, way out of play. Nowhere near. And Els found himself, kind of miraculously, I guess, in one of those piles, way left on number 11. He asked for relief, thinking this is piled for removal. So good on Ernie for even knowing that material piled for removal is, by definition, ground under repair, and he may have been entitled to relief. He was literally in jail. So this is the classic get out of jail free. The official on the hole said no. I don't think so. Or either said that or no, but I can get a second opinion. Ultimately, he did ask for or receive a second opinion, and Will came on to the site, to the scene, and without hesitation, gave him relief. And I had the good fortune of working closely with Will and learning from Will, and the way he explained it, we don't leave things piled at Augusta. We don't leave things laying around. So it was piled for removal. He's probably right. So therefore, he was entitled to relief. He got relief, and ultimately saved himself a stroke because he was able to drop it without penalty. He still made a bogey on the hole, but instead of declaring the ball unplayable with an additional penalty stroke, he went on to lose by one. And I thought from that moment on, as I was watching that tournament unfold, I thought if he wins this one, that ruling is going to be scrutinized. And I'm sure, Brad, you were alive to watch that one. That
I wasn't was, 19. And I, yes, indeed. Well, and it's, as you mentioned, Ed, I think it's important for players to have at least a good working familiarity with the rules and know these things. I can think of a local course here in the Denver area where they have some trees that have gone down. And I mean, the diameter on some of these is a couple or 3 feet. They've cut them into 3 or 4 foot sections and piled them up. And they've been there for 9 or 10 years in some cases now. When players get in those, they are clearly not going to be removed because they've been there and they will be there until they return to Mother Earth.
Yeah, I think the situation that I always think is very common is grass clippings that get thrown into the native areas or whatever. And they're clearly not going to be removed. They're just because they're organically being sort of composted. No relief for that. And I have seen players try to make an argument if the ball comes to rest near some of those clippings that they are piled for removal. That's probably not going to be a very convincing argument.
No, but as you make the point with Ernie at the Masters, and I was in Orlando this spring doing a NCAA national championship. I was the head official. And when I was doing the setup work on the course, getting it painted and doing all the ground under repair and other things, on the right side of the 18th hole, there was a big pile of things back there. And usually when I work a tournament, I'll find the superintendent and ask, are you going to remove those eventually, or are they just there forever? That way we have a definitive answer from the golf course. And in this case, they were piling natural materials there basically to be a compost pile. And I mentioned it to the coaches during the coaches meeting. I said, you know, it is way right of 18. I said, I don't think we'll have any players over there, but know that it's there and know that it's not piled for removal. Well, over the course of 5 days of tournament golf, I think we had three or four players in there. So I didn't think it would come into play. And sure enough, we're over there making rulings.
Yeah, it's amazing. And if you hadn't done that, probably would have had even more balls over there. I don't know. Okay. Last thing before we leave the drum roll for number one of our most notable get out of jail free rulings. One other last comment that Will Nicholson shared, and I don't know if this was sort of a pang of guilt or any kind of insecurity about his ruling, but he did emphasize what a miraculous shot that Ernie Els hit, and that the get out of jail free was really more of Ernie's skill and the tiny little window he was able to extract himself from through. So I think it was funny that Will, I'm sure he was right. I mean, but it just shows you, you know, when you give good players opportunity, you know, they can do things that we could never do. Okay. The last one also involves Ernie Els. And the reason it made number one, for me anyway, was because he went on to win the tournament, and the history books would probably be different had this ruling not occurred, although that you never know. So this was in 1994 at Oakmont. I remember this one very vividly. And as we talk through this, I'll explain part of the reason I remember it so well is what happened and some of the postmortems and comments that followed. But Dr. Trey Holland, who I went to several of his rules workshops, he was a president of the USGA, chair of the Rules Golf Committee, one of the most humble, likable, dry sense of humor. I just love Trey Holland. And he was walking with Els final round. And on the very first hole, I believe, first hole, he hit his ball into the rough. And it was in a terrible lie, as it typically would happen in U.S. Opens. And there was a television crane blocking or on his line, a temporary removal obstruction. And the ruling that unfolded is Holland gave him free relief for a TIO. It did meet the what he thought the definition. It was intervening between him and the hole, as we talked about earlier, and he got a free drop, and it resulted in him getting a much more favorable lie, and off he went. It was later learned that that was not a TIO. It was the I being for immovable. It was actually movable, and the crane had been moved throughout the tournament and could have easily, it was on wheels, so it could have been moved and Els would have been forced to play. I've heard different versions of the story. To Trey's credit, he took full responsibility. He just said, I made a mistake. He didn't blame anybody. He didn't make excuses. He just owned his mistake. What I heard later, and again, I don't know what is true and what isn't true, was that his observer, the person walking with the walking rules official or the rules referee, told Trey over the radio that that was not movable. So he ruled accordingly. So it wasn't a bad ruling. It was bad information that led to a bad ruling. Again, it doesn't really matter ultimately, but that it does give us the opportunity to talk about the roles of forward observers and rules officials. But at any rate, to Trey's credit, he took responsibility and he'd be so self-deprecating about it. I went to a rules workshop he did years and years later. And when we got to this rule, he said, everybody knows I know this one better than anyone. And I got a pretty big chuckle. What are your memories of that one?
I don't remember it from the time, but you know, certainly as studying the rules, it's been one of the ones that you see after the fact. And you know, we're all human. Not everybody is perfect. I think nobody is perfect. And we make the occasional mistake. One of the things that I do when I'm the chief official for a tournament is I try to do everything I can to get the rules crew on the same page so that we're consistent, so that we make the same rulings, so that no matter which player or which official, everybody should get the same deal from the same situation. That's one of the things that I really strive for. And you know, you'll, if you talk to any of the officials that work on crews that, that I'm in charge of, I do extra paperwork for things like, these are the places marked ground under repair. These are, you know, the, how this hole is set up. And that's all in an effort to try and make everything as consistent as we can, knowing full well that at some point humans make mistakes and we just have to deal with that.
Yeah, a couple of things come to mind from that. Consistency. Another, and this came to mind as you were talking there, that in this case with Els, that crane was immovable up until the last group, and Els was in the last group. But at that point, it could have been moved because it was no longer needed in that location. Well, that would be a terrible thing to say everybody other, every, all the other players that preceded Els would have been given relief, but he was, would have been denied relief, because you don't want that to happen. I mean, obviously there's a lot of unfairness in golf. The player who tees off in the thick of the bad weather is obviously going to have a lot bigger challenge than the person who played, you know, early in the morning. But to the extent we as rules officials can level the playing field, that's certainly one of our major primary goals.
Absolutely.
The other thing that came to mind as you were talking there, Brad, and before we wrap up, is as you've been talking, and I love getting your recent examples. You know, you have the good fortune and the talent and the time and a lot of other things to be able to get out there and travel and do this and see things and learn from some of the best out there. Just how important it is to get there early, to write a notice, to mark the golf course.
I have two site visits coming up in late September, early October for national championship regionals and finals that will happen next May. And I'll spend a lot of time this winter, Ed, poring over a notice to players, poring over the notes that I make for each hole for the rules officials. And I will spend dozens, maybe 100 or more hours over the wintertime when it's snowing outside, working on things for spring golf. And, you know, I'll work on it, put it aside for a couple of days, then I'll go back and change a word. And boy, I try to make these things as close to perfect as I can, because the more preparation I do in advance of an event, the fewer problems and fewer questions that we can't answer during the event. And boy, I think that preparation really goes a long way. It's no different than a player going to the range and working on a club that they want to get right for a shot. We work on paperwork and we work on understanding the course and trying to set it up so that it will play fairly and well for all the players in the competition, and then get out of the way and let them play some good golf.
Yeah, that's, I like the analogy of just like the players work on that club or that shot, rules officials have their own skills they need to hone. And I've often said, if I have one person to help me with a tournament, I would say, do not show up the day of the tournament, but help me, please help me with the course marking and writing a good notice to competitors. If you help me with that, my day of day is going to be infinitely easier. And I think what you just said sums that up beautifully.
Thank you.
Okay, before we get out of jail here, not free, if you've listened this long, you definitely paid a price. So thank you for sitting in with us. So Brad, before we sign off, are there any other ones that come to mind for you that fall into this category of get out of jail free that we didn't talk about?
You know, Ed, I think we covered five that are really memorable to golfers who have been around for a while or have studied the history of golf. And I can't think of any that I'd put on this list or replace any of these with.
Well, if you're listening and you can, we'd love to hear from you. Please send me an email. I get so many of these. I'll try to get back, Lee, as quick as I can. The people who've listened to Spirit of the Game, send me an email, emate@coloradogolf.org, and I will definitely reply. If you can think of other famous get out of jail frees, we'd love to hear from you. And Brad, I'm going to give you the last word here. As a volunteer, and again, if you're still listening, then you love the rules. So if you love the rules and you want to become a Brad Weasley and get involved, what what would you say to a listener?
I would say jump in, volunteer for the CGA. It is made in the last 15 years, basically from the time I retired from full-time work, it has made a huge contribution to my life. I get way more out of volunteering both CGA and other organizations than I give. And you meet some wonderful people, you get to spend time in a place where folks are happy and having a good time, and you get to stay active in the community. If you've got a few hours to devote, come out. We will help you. You know, there are ways other than rules officials. If the rules seem complicated or intimidating, we'll help you with that. But there are other ways to volunteer. There's course handicapping. There's volunteering at tournaments with other roles. And if you're interested in the rules, we'll train you. I started knowing very little. And through a lot of other people helping me along, really got to a point where now I'm happy to pay it forward and help others learn and get into doing this if you have an interest and some time available. We'd love to have you join us.
Well said. And again, just like I said a minute ago, emate@coloradogolf.org. I'd love to hear from you if you're interested in volunteering, and we can definitely, believe me, we love that. And you said it well, paying it forward. There's nothing that I enjoy more than sharing my love of golf through the lens of the rules with others. And I just think it's one of the most delightful parts of all what I get to do every day. So, Brad, thank you so much for joining. You definitely exceeded my expectations, which were already high. So thanks for sitting in with me.
Ed, it was a lot of fun. I'd happily join you anytime in the future.
Thank you so much. That's it for this month. Tune in again next month for another edition of Spirit of the Game.